and welcome to another episode of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And my name is Bill Cundiff, and our sponsor this hour is Pape Machinery, our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer. Pape will get you pretty much anything you want when it comes to John Deere products. You want tractors, mowers, implements, they've got it all up there. Full part sales and service. They're located at 3119 Twinview Boulevard in the city of Shasta Lake, right between Oasis and Pine Grove exits. So go up and see them. They got some great financing going on right now for the John Deere products. Or you can give them a call at 530-226-9226 or catch them on the web at papemachinery.com.
And I was doing a little shopping in there the other day. I was looking for some gloves. They didn't have my size, but they had really good selection of gloves.
Yeah, got a lot of gloves.
So if you want like work gloves, you want like yard gloves, you want rose cutting gloves. I was kind of surprised at the selection of gloves. But better than that, they had this little miniature chainsaw thing.
Oh, yeah, the little handheld one-handed. That's a brush.
Because I cut down this huge bush, and I did take the saw down there and do it because that's the way I prefer to prune is with a saw. And but this little thing, like, I mean, just boy, it'll.
Yeah, it'll cut your finger off quick.
Yes, I was planning on not learning about that part. All the kids in my neighborhood who had snowblowers, they were all missing a finger.
That's right.
I knew who had a snowblower. Oh, my goodness. But anyway, yeah, so if you're looking for one of those little handheld...
little handheld chainsaw.
What is it, like 4 inches long, the little chainsaw part?
It's got like a 6 or 8 inch bar on it with a little saw, and you hold it with one hand, and you can prune. And
you would think that it would be like, you know, come on.
Tonka toy. No, it cuts.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. It cuts. I saw something through. It was like 3 inches thick, that one thing.
Zip.
It was very fun. So anyway, I'm a big fan of manual implements, but I'm hooked on the miniature chainsaw now. All right. So let's see. Here we go. Who will represent the liberty of our prosperity? It's the title of our show for today. I thought that was kind of great. It was a title that Nathan came up with. Nathan Deshmaker. He is up in Montana. We spoke with him, back in December, I suppose. And he had some new info for us, so I thought we should have him back on. He's a senior research associate and policy analyst specializing in federal and local government administrative procedures. And I have to tell you, there's not exactly an overabundance of people who are smart about that. He also works with land and natural resource policymaking, local government relations, and program management. He's also an accomplished musician and a self-taught theologian with a love for the classics. Good for you, Nathan. Can't have too many classics, especially these days. He's worked with local governments to identify and challenge attacks on small farm and ranch operations facing increasing pressure and regulation by forces and groups outside of Montana and many times outside the United States. He and his family raise registered feeder calves in central Montana. So welcome back, Nathan. We're happy to have you.
Yeah, for sure. Well, glad to have the opportunity to come back on with you guys. First thing, just you hear me good on your end, yeah?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, it's perfect.
Okay. Well, I always want to verify that on the call-in deals or some of these Zoom meetings, make sure everybody can hear me. So
yeah, we're sort of rude. Anyway. We'll interrupt you and tell you if we can't hear you.
Yeah, no, that's fine. So yeah, no shortage of things going on. Been plenty busy in a lot of ways since last time I was on the program with you guys. And last time we talked a lot about grizzly bears and some other things, I suppose. But there's a lot of things happening through Bureau of Land Management, Department of Interior, and obviously other departments too, but a lot of my focus is Department of Interior because natural resource industries is kind of my wheelhouse in tracking how rules are being promulgated by various federal departments, primarily the Bureau of Land Management, because they happen to control a significant amount of land compared to some of the other agencies. So I think, we have a pretty good discussion opportunity here, I think, ahead of us on connecting some dots and talking about some current things that are happening in the federal bureaucracy. So,
yeah, there's a lot to talk about there in the federal bureaucracy. We'll try to limit it for today. But you know, I'm always kind of mindful that we would have people listening, perhaps that don't live near public land. Maybe they don't even live in the United States. But bottom line is, if you do live in the U.S. and maybe you don't live by public land, maybe you never go to a national park, maybe you don't even know what the Bureau of Land Management does, you have no idea. Bottom line is, you're paying for it. Like, that's kind of why you care. You're paying for it.
Yeah, it's not federal land.
Yeah, yeah, and we try to beat that out of everyone. Stop saying federal land. It's public. It belongs to the public. I think sometimes the agencies forget, and they do think it's federal land and belongs to them. With Interior just kind of on a 30,000-foot view, what kind of change have you seen, or, you know, what have you noticed since Deb Haaland became the new secretary under Biden?
Yeah. Well, I think the first thing is you...
Yeah, I like that. Yeah.
Well, it's a lot. You know, a year ago, I thought it was a lot going on and a lot of problems then, and it's, you wouldn't think it could get more things moving through some of these departments and what's going on, but they've managed to do that. But where they started, you know, with like the 30 by 30 initiative, for example, which for your listening audience, that's the goals and objectives that were set out right off day one with the Biden administration to permanently conserve 30% of lands and waters by 2030. So that set the federal departments on a trajectory that have administrative control over a lot of these lands to some extent. And, you know, everybody says, well, it's just a land grab process for the 30 by 30 agenda. But, and some of that's true because there's some existing laws and things in place like the National Heritage Areas and federal monuments and existing frameworks that they're utilizing to try to tie up more land and into non-use, essentially. But for to really accomplish what they want to do and some of these targets is, what I see happening is they're now, especially starting in 2023, doing basically a wholesale regulatory rewrite for Bureau of Land Management, and even the Council on Environmental Quality and some of the White House oversight departments that are supposed to be making sure these agencies are following procedures that protect the interests of local economies and et cetera. So they're rewriting a lot of regulations and promulgating rules that gives new administrative opportunities and avenues for federal agencies to tie up essentially more land. So that's one thing that I've been tracking is how are the federal agencies that are functioning under these executive orders to accomplish these high-level objectives, how are they actually proceeding in their deliberations and rulemaking processes to accomplish those things? So there's several items we can touch probably today in that conversation.
And you know,
for sure.
Before we leave it, you mentioned monuments, and I'm always mindful that in case people don't speak speak, you know, federal environmental bureaucrat speak, monuments aren't a guy on a horse with a sword made out of marble. You know, the monuments are swaths of land. And I don't know what the biggest monument is. What are some, like, they always want to try to do the Siskiyou Crest Monument, and that's between the Oregon and California borders, and they're looking to tie up, I forget, it was a zillion acres, in this monument because it's some biodiversity habitat, blah, blah, blah. But it takes it out of the realm of public property, and I think that's the most important. I mean, it's really, if you hear that they're going to designate a monument in your area and it isn't a man on a horse with a sword, then they're looking to, you know, snag up a giant chunk of property that you'll likely I know you would know. What are the parameters? I know you can't take any wheeled vehicles in. I mean,
we can't build anything.
Well, you can't. Yeah, you can't own any property.
I don't know if you can even improve, can you?
Yeah, can you rattle off the limits of Monument? I should have looked earlier, but I didn't.
Yeah, well, so the first thing a monument does is it restricts any further mineral exploration or development within the boundaries of a monument. I think that's one of the big motivating factors for some of the monuments, especially in southern Utah, the Grand Staircase and the Bears Ears monuments, which are very large. And there's a lot of uranium under the ground there. You know, they tolerate livestock grazing, but it's still another layer of regulatory mechanism as being a monument. You know, the monuments in Utah, they want to bring in things like dark sky reserves, layer those things over the monuments. So that means no campfire out there while you're out there, you know, in the desert in the monument. And we got to keep the sky dark so we can see the stars nice and clear and whatnot. So there's just things like that that end up being layered over monuments as well. But for the restrictions, one, you're cut off of your mineral estate. And then two, you're under another layer of regulatory process that can dictate your livestock grazing utilization and other things as well. So it's not, and like you said, there may be some Indian artifacts or some kind of a monument rock or something that they want to preserve. But the Antiquities Act, which gives the president the authority to withdraw these monuments out of the public domain, you know, it says in statute that they're supposed to be the smallest size necessary to preserve the antiquities or whatever that are therein. So the courts, there's litigation moving with the state of Utah on those monuments, actually, that's one of the elements that they're challenging, is that the courts have really never ruled on with the Antiquities Act and the president, is how much is enough to preserve these antiquities.
Right.
Hopefully that gets resolved in the courts soon.
Well, that would be great, because every time they do this, it's the other thing too is it isn't like there's a trial period. You know, they don't just test it out and then, I guess we don't need that much land. Let's make it smaller. I don't think that's probably ever happened. Yeah. So you were talking about I guess we've got another couple of minutes here before the break, but you were saying that the use of executive order, and I always just have such, I mean, I think most people do have big problems with executive order, because once you do that, you've bypassed all the representatives in both the House and the Senate.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, coming out of this coming up break, we can get into that a little more. But yeah, that's the principal issue here, is a breakdown of the separation of powers. And in a nutshell, what's happening with the executive branch trying to accomplish these timetables and objectives without explicit congressional delegation, they're essentially usurping Article I authority to themselves to write law and draft rules that haven't been delegated specifically by the Congress. And that causes a whole array of other issues. But for their biodiversity conservation objectives, they pretty much have to do that. Otherwise, they're not going to make headway towards those goals and objectives, because so far Congress hasn't delegated that broad biodiversity conservation initiative framework over to the executive branch.
Yeah, see, it's a little bit like the Waters of the U.S. rule, the WOTUS rule that came out through the Supreme Court last week or the week before. I mean, really recently. And
yep.
I don't sit around all day and read Supreme Court cases, but I'll tell you, that's one worth reading. It's not that long. And the opinions were pretty great. Clarence Thomas's opinion is worth reading just because he's funny, and he works in a lot of expression into his opinion. But basically, what we see out here all the time is they take, you know, somebody plows a field and whoop, now you got a wetlands, you know, because some water gathered in the little furrows, and they said in the broad stroke of it that if that water isn't part of something that's significant, ongoing, navigable, all those kinds of things that we all think, I mean, we don't think that mud puddles are waters of the U.S., but that's kind of how it's gotten. So the Supreme Court rule changed that, and the Army Corps of Engineers now is trying to figure out what to do with that. They haven't, you know, it's funny, they out here anyway, they have said, well, we haven't really worked on that. And I know when our local congressional office called to ask them how that would be affecting some of the cases that they had working, they phoned the top dogs in the Army Corps, and they didn't even know the case was out, according to them.
But not surprising, I suppose, but geez.
Yeah, if you didn't know the Supreme Court just told you you couldn't do stuff, I guess you can keep doing it. What a deal.
Yeah.
We'll be right back with our guest, Nathan Deshmaker. We are speaking to you from We the People Radio, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
What shall we do about them when they move into your neighborhood? They take over, but good. They want you all body and soul. Then it's just your body. Then they go. What shall we do about them?
This is Officer Joe with your marijuana safety message. Is your marijuana killing you? A testing of 1,000 NorCal dispensary samples found the majority had toxic mold or substances harmful to humans. As a bud tender, recommended THC products for treatment of medical conditions while you get sicker or exacerbate mental health issues. Get professional medical help and sue the dispensaries for the product and advice liability. Marijuana is not medicine for most Americans, and there's no medicine that is smoked. Remember, let's be careful out there.
Compliance. We just need your compliance. You will feel no pain anymore, no more defiance. We just need your compliance. Just give us your compliance. We won't let you feel lost anymore, no more self-reliance.
I didn't realize how fitting that would be. Very fitting, though. Yeah, we won't let you feel lost anymore. You just follow us. Do exactly what we say. Nothing more, nothing less. So Nathan, what are you seeing with the rollout of these rule changes? Maybe explain to people a little bit how that process goes, because this isn't something that most people deal with, I guess, on a daily basis.
Yeah. Well, there's some, that's part of the problem. You know, the Congress has statutes that are basically function as bylaws for these agencies that promulgate these rules. And, you know, there's supposed to be adequate public involvement. The regulations for implementing the National Environmental Policy Act, for instance, says that public scrutiny is essential for the implementing the provisions of the act. But when you have the rapid pace rulemaking of federal departments taking place off the Federal Register and changing rules and issuing new procedures and all these things, to the point that even somebody like myself, who functions somewhat in this realm and has some level of subject matter expertise on the process, is it's difficult to keep up. You know, if I, being somebody that functions within that realm, to analyze these things and to bring accountability to that process, if I'm being disenfranchised to some extent, how much more so is the general public, who is not at all, doesn't even know many of these things are even happening through the federal departments under the executive branch that have broad impacts on really all of us? Because, like you said earlier, tax money is ultimately funding these administrative agencies to implement rules and regulations that touch hundreds of millions of acres of land and real estate. And this administration has made a priority to reduce, shut off, or severely limit access and utilization of our mineral resources and other productive uses of our lands, especially in the West. So it's important for people to understand this, because at the end of the day, it does affect each and every one of us and has broad impacts on the national economy and political process. So,
well, and
very, very important.
And looking at like the kind of industry you're in, ultimately, if you want to eat, and these rules are really destructive to farming and ranching, your ability to afford food and get it are going to ultimately be impacted. We can't make everything a park.
Exactly.
Unless we want to eat bugs.
Well, you can't, not only a park, but, you know, that's one thing. The problem that's happening now, you know, there's specific agencies, like we have national parks, for instance. We have national wildlife refuges, and those are managed. That real estate is managed by the National Park Service, and then the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service manages our game reserves. But what's happening is there, BLM, Bureau of Land Management, happens to have the most administrative jurisdiction and management over most of the lands. We, you know, our forefathers created these agencies to set aside certain lands and national parks to preserve those natural characteristics. And in the, and to the degree that they did that, most people didn't have too big of an issue with that. But now you have massive pressure that's trying to direct Bureau of Land Management, who traditionally is directed by statute to manage lands for productive use and multiple use and sustained yield, by making available the resources on that land available for private enterprise to invest in those resources, convert those resources for the benefit of the American people. That's what the, that was, that's the mission of Bureau of Land Management in a nutshell. But what's happening is the environmental lobby and a massive amount of influence in our federal departments and special interest pressure is shifting that focus of Bureau of Land Management towards focuses that lie within U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. They're trying to make the Bureau of Land Management focus on fish and wildlife preservation and conservation, which never was part of the original mission of BLM and its statutory purpose.
Right. That's the real kicker, is we're seeing all these agencies that were there to manage. The reason we have multiple agencies, well, I mean, I have a lot of opinions on that, but you could say they were there for different purposes, and now they're all being morphed into, yeah, like tree huggers, for lack of a, you know, more succinct term. I guess they just, everything is save everything, get all the ologists out there, let's find some random, you know, species of bushes. It blows my mind that we have bushes on the endangered species list. Bushes and plants.
Yeah. Well, and that's, so the Endangered Species Act is a big, that's where you get the overlay into your private lands is, and like you said, mentioned WOTUS earlier, Waters of the USA, that's another avenue they really reach over into private lands as well. But there's, so there's systemic issues just within the federal departments, and I would say that BLM, Bureau of Land Management, is off mission in many respects. And this is proof, you know, I'll verify this, for instance, in 1976 when the Game Range Act amended the 1966 Act for the National Wildlife Refuge System, there was a congressional committee that reported in the amendment of this body of law to manage the game ranges, because originally they were set up with dual management. U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and Bureau of Land Management shared management of the game range. And there's some interesting admissions that the congressional committee made in that report regarding Bureau of Land Management. In the reporting on that House Rule 5512, the House Merchant Marine and Fisheries Committee stated that clearly The record of BLM's wildlife management has not been an encouraging one. The committee believes that the reason for this arises from the fact that BLM has a number of other important missions, such as mining, logging, livestock grazing, and fossil fuel development, which often conflict with wildlife management. In performing these conflicting missions, BLM is unable to devote sufficient attention to the needs of wildlife. In short, its mission is not wildlife protection or enhancement. That is a direct quote from the House Merchant Marine and Fisheries Committee. In 1976, the same year they brought in the Federal Land Policy Management Act, acknowledging the Bureau of Land Management's mission as being mining, logging, livestock grazing, and fossil fuel development. So pretty clear, in my opinion.
Yeah, you would think. but as you know, we have a great example in our district here. The Army Corps of Engineers is no longer allowed to regulate ongoing farming practices. That actually was written into law some, I'm going to say, like 6 years ago. And when questioned by the member of Congress who got that passed, who said, "Hey, wait a second. This guy's," it was John Duarte, who's now a member of Congress. It's like he's farming land that has been farmed for over 100 years. This is an ongoing farming practice. You're not here to you can't regulate it. And they looked at him and said, "Oh, that's not the way we read that."
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
I mean, shortest amendment known to man, right? The Army Corps of Engineers can not regulate ongoing farming practices. That was the whole bill. That was the entire bill. And yet their response was, "That's not the way we read that." So even simple sometimes doesn't work. You know, people think it's because it's all so complicated.
They just want to play by their own rules. And unfortunately, it doesn't look like the administration will step in and make them play by the rules. So they just continue to step outside the bounds.
Yeah. Not this administration, anyway. I think they're down for it. So with Deb Haaland, what have you seen from her as far as her putting her stamp on it?
Well, she has been, you know, in the forefront with... Because another interesting dynamic here, and we'll probably get a little more into this coming up, but there's international connections to what's being brought forward through the executive branch and its departments domestically on these conservation initiatives and biodiversity objectives. And those things really originate. Executive Order 1400A didn't just initiate the 30 by 30 and some of these other conservation objectives for the nation. It reinitiated the process for submitting the United States Instrument of Acceptance to rejoin the Paris Accord. It directed the federal departments that make up the National Climate Task Force, the same departments that are promulgating these rules through the Federal Register, through the local field offices, are the same ones that developed the nationally determined contribution under the Paris Accord, directed under that executive order, which is, by the way, a 50 to 52% reduction of greenhouse gas emissions by 2030. That's the NDC, the nationally determined contribution under Paris, for the country. That is an economy-wide target, and that's consistent with Article 4 and Chapter 4, or Paragraph 4 of the Paris Accord. It's an economy-wide targeted objective. So Deb Haaland has been in the forefront in press releases and other things, pushing for, and because she's the Secretary of Interior, and the Secretary of Interior has a whole bunch of federal agencies underneath of it, U.S. Fish and Wildlife, all these departments or agencies I've mentioned so far are under the Department of Interior, of which Deb Haaland is the Secretary of. She's the head of it. So you have Bureau of Land Management, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and a whole host of other agencies under her headship. And she issued Secretarial Order 3399, which is the the secretarial order that carries forward the executive directives that were promulgated. So you have the president who issues executive orders, and then that goes down to his heads of departments, and then they issue, like Deb Haaland issued pursuant to that executive order, a secretarial order pushing for implementation of those objectives down to her agencies below her. And then those are the agencies that then, through the climate action plan that they also developed under 1408, are developing rules and regulatory rewrites and everything they're doing on the ground to create frameworks and administrative options for them to be able to accomplish those objectives. So there's a lot going on, and these are dots most people in the policy realm are not connecting, is how the domestic land use policy that we see unfolding is being influenced by international targets and timetables that have not been decided by the Congress, by the way. They're being decided by international bodies through international conventions, and we have the executive branch entirely directing all of its subsidiary departments and agencies under that framework.
It's no wonder people are like, gosh, I think I don't want to go to the public meeting about this. I mean, they go and it's like, you know, oh, you can have public comment, and people think, well, like, what am I going to say? I just don't think it can be overstated that you've got to have people in your community who really do want to track this stuff, and resources, and folks like you that function as resources, so that when people do have to weigh on in these, you know, on these policies that are happening around the country, because you can't be everywhere. Well, I don't want to blow your deal, your superhero status, but you probably just don't want to be everywhere. They've got to be able to weigh in and make sense, and that's hard.
It is. It's hard work, and it takes. We've let ourselves get so far down this pathway that it is difficult to traverse the bureaucracy in some respects. But I would also submit that what saves me a lot of time and resources is that George Washington said, patriots are governed by principles, and dupes adhere to principles, or not principles, interests. So patriots adhere to principles, dupes give in to interests. So the way I cut through the bureaucracy is I go back to the original compacts of our government. Because like what I just said, for example, I'm talking about how our federal executive branch basically is selling out the country by usurping to itself Article 1 powers to accomplish international timetables and objectives without congressional approval. So, to me, the way you deal with that from a principled basis is, what does our Constitution say? What are the enumerated powers that are granted to the executive branch? What are the enumerated powers granted to the congressional legislative branch? What are the enumerated powers to the judicial? And that's our Constitution, by the way. The first three articles of our federal Constitution, Article 1, legislative, Article 2, executive, and Article 3 is your judiciary. And then Article 4 is what establishes what our founders called a compound republic, which is the aggregate of republican states that have another framework within their sovereign sphere of a judicial, legislative, and executive branch. It's what James Madison called a compound republic. And what that does, through the brilliance of our founders in setting up that system, is it aggregates the power to the local level. But what the executive branch is essentially doing through all this stuff, it's all basically an attempt to centralize power.
Yes.
And pull it out of local bottom-up frameworks and have it coming down from the top in. And that's counter to the Federal Land Policy Management Act and a whole host of other laws, including obviously our Constitution.
Well, it's extremely, it makes people feel very, very powerless, and it's extremely difficult to fight, which is, I'm sure, why they're doing it that way. Hang on to that thought. Let's pick that right up when we come back. Our guest is Nathan Dishmaker. He is up in Montana, actually, chatting with us today on Sunday. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Los Angeles, kind of making small talk, killing time, flirting with the flight attendants, 30,000 feet. feet above could be Oklahoma. Just a bunch of square cornfields and wheat farms, man, it all looks the same. Miles and miles of back roads and highways connecting little towns with funny names. Who'd want to live down there in the middle of nowhere? They've never drove through Indiana. Met the man who plowed that earth, planted that seed, busted his ass for you and me. You're caught a harvest moon in Kansas. They'd understand why God made those flyover states. I bet that mile-long Santa Fe.
This is Officer Joe with your marijuana safety message. Did you know that the marketing of marijuana is a misogynistic and racist activity? That's right. Most marijuana corporations are owned and controlled by rich, fat cat white corporate types, and most dispensaries are placed into depressed communities of color. These communities can least afford the chains of drug addiction and corporate greed. For more information about marijuana, please visit sources like ALM, Americans Against Legalizing Marijuana, at www.aalm.info. And remember, let's be careful out there.
So don't you like, act now, supplies are running out. Allow if you're still alive, 6 to 8 years to arrive. And if you follow the med, be out tomorrow. But if the author shun, you might as well be walking on the sun. You might as well be walking on the sun. You might as well be walking on the sun.
Figured I should pull out some of our fun global warming songs. I have my special favorite that will be coming later on. Nathan knows our friend Debbie Bocciacalupi. That's how we met him. And Debbie and I discovered a song that was so rare, so bad, and just so ear-splitting. We do love playing it, and we'll play it for you, Nathan. Probably on our outgoing song. So you can just, when the really horrible song comes, you'll be like, what is wrong with these people? Well, that's why we play it, because it's just mind-bendingly horrible. But it just screams, you know, environmentalists. This is the kind of stuff they love and listen to. So with the overreach on all of this, I think it's important to kind of note that we don't have a Bureau of Land Management in the state government, but like we have federal EPA, state EPA. We have a lot of duplication at the state level, and I think that makes it even easier for the federal government to overreach because they're kind of all in bed together.
Yeah, that often happens. You know, well, you have both dynamics playing out right now in the country because some states, for instance, are bulwarks against federal overreach by bringing accountability to the process from the state side. But states like California and Washington and many other states in the nation, it's the opposite. Some, you know, Washington state, and I say Washington just because I'm more familiar with what's going on in Washington than California, but it's probably the same there too to some extent. But there is some illegitimate federal state partnerships that have developed under these climate objectives that state agencies and executive departments are streamlining. I would actually submit to you that the only reason the Biden administration is able to accomplish what it is accomplishing in the climate policy arena is because almost half of the states at the executive level of those states in the government have bought onto and are parallel with those international objectives and the decarbonization agenda. And states like Washington, they're almost worse than the federal government agencies in what they're implementing and trying to bring forward.
Yeah, and I don't know how we, unless we, I guess, you know, we can go forward and, you know, defund them and just kind of, you know, by way of education. Defunding doesn't necessarily mean just blanket taking money away from an agency. Sometimes defunding, actually the really good part of defunding, would be preventing them from spending money on certain things, which means they can't email, they can't phone, they can't call, they can't attend they're prevented from using any taxpayer resources on whatever it is that has been deemed defunded. And so maybe we do some really targeted stuff like that to save ourselves.
Well, that's one thing. On the congressional front, those are some things that can be done. The other side is your local magistrates, for instance, because Washington at the state level is going that way. Many local jurisdictions aren't necessarily on board. So there's some opportunity there to be a counter to the initiatives moving forward. And like you said, the defunding is important because the Inflation Reduction Act, the Build Back Better Act, all those monies, the coalition states that are on board with these objectives are, in my opinion, inequitable beneficiaries of those dollars that are ear-tagged for green development and the transition to a decarbonized, carbon-neutral, quote-unquote, economy by whatever date. So defunding would be important in some respects. First of all, my biggest issue with this is you have governors traveling over to these international conferences saying they're going to use 60% of the gross domestic product, which is their coalition states, to transition the entire North American economy. But back to the federal constitution, Article 1, Section 10 of the U.S. Constitution explicitly prohibits states from entering into or partaking in those types of international processes. That's something that's specifically enumerated and reserved on the federal front. And even on the federal front, there's congressional oversight and limitations on what the president does in the international communities. One of those is a two-thirds Senate approval and congressional delegation to the departments, etc. But states for sure. So here's the thing. Should Inslee be funded by state taxpayer dollars to go over to Scotland and sit in an international convention and say that he's going to accomplish those international objectives by using and leveraging his state economy to do it?
Yeah, and his...
I don't think that's very legitimate.
No, and his executive powers within the state to the agencies that he has to delegate them to go out. Well, California is a terrible poster child for all those things. You know, the California Air Resources Board and all of those sorts of things. We're going to, you know, they come up with all this nutty stuff. We're going to get rid of cars. We're not going to have, you know, it's just a laundry list of regulatory craziness that makes people, honestly, it makes people kind of nuts. The good part is most of it that they talk about, they can't really do. You know, I mean, you could say you're going to do it, but if you can't actually do it, it's not a real rule.
Yeah, I get emails from, I serve as cooperating agency status on some of these rulemaking processes, and there's a federal official on an email, one of them has an email, and you know people at their emails will put a quote at the bottom oftentimes.
Yeah.
And this particular official has a quote, a Mark Twain quote at the bottom, and said, because they didn't know it was impossible, they did it anyways.
Wow. It's kind of telling.
That was in relationship to revising a whole bunch of RMPs for solar development, et cetera. Or that person is involved in those realms. But I just wanted to make a note of that quote. It's, well, we didn't know it was impossible, so we just did it anyways. But they failed to point out the fact that when Mark Twain was saying that in the context of a free market enterprise, where individual entrepreneurs take the risk and suffer the consequences of that risk, good or bad. But when you delegate, government cannot function in the position to take entrepreneurial risks to drive market decisions and prices in the market. They do it all the time, but that's the problem, is people in the free market, when you fail, you're the one that suffers. But the government, when it takes on these objectives and these initiatives, we didn't know it was impossible, so we just did it. Well, if they fail, they can just pass that on to the taxpayer to absorb the loss.
Right.
And one example of that is Office of Management and Budget issued a report a couple years ago where Department of Energy, I believe, spent millions of dollars, like tens of millions of dollars on plans to develop carbon capture systems and facilities that were never built. So all that taxpayer money flowing into a federal department, you know, and there you go. We didn't know it was impossible, so we just did it anyways. It's like, well, that might work in the free market process where we have leaps and bounds in entrepreneurial development and prosperity and progress, but that historically in our country, and what Mark Twain was talking about, is individual people taking those risks and doing the impossible, not government agencies and departments using other people's money to push these unrealistic initiatives to transition our whole grid to a carbon neutral system. And who at the end of the day pays the tab for those losses? The taxpayer.
Yeah. Well, I think we first saw that in with Solyndra. I mean, the government, you know, spent how many millions and millions of dollars backing that ridiculous plan and eventually went broke, and the taxpayers paid for all of it. That would have never happened if it was private money and private entrepreneurs with the government staying out of it. It would have never happened.
Yeah. Well, in California, see, so not only do you lose in direct taxation, but you also lose an inflationary result of government regulation that drives up costs because it creates a scarcity. And California is a perfect example of that. I have a chart in one of my documents, an all-sector electricity rate change versus wind and solar capacity in California, and it's charted out from 2008 to 2021. And for the state of California, in direct proportion to wind and solar development in the state, you guys have experienced a 58.3% rate increase that is directly charted and correlated with the subsidizing of wind and solar development in the state. The non-penetration states, 41 other states that never went down that pathway extensively in the same time frame, only had a 9.5% rate increase. And those are the states like Montana where we have strong, or for now anyways, have strong, you know, carbon-based energy sources in our coal and our natural gas facilities and energy production sectors. But if we all go the way California goes, even though Northwestern Energy and these people are saying, oh, the rates won't go up even though we're going net zero, well, I have empirical data right in front of me charting out the consequence of going that pathway for California. And not only do you have the tax issue, but you have the rate increase issue, and those are all problems that are passed on to the consumer, and government regulators really are not held accountable oftentimes.
Well, what, how much of Texas, how much of their problem with you know, when all their wind power froze during the winter and so many Texans were without power for weeks. How much of that was the government's play and funding all this green energy business?
Yeah, well, that's Texas. Yeah, exactly. That happened. Montana, I mean, we would have had outages in Montana and the Dakotas and several states a year ago if it wasn't for the electric cooperative spreading out the impact and having incremental shutdowns across the grid.
Mm-hmm.
So there's been close calls in other situations across the West and other parts of the country. But yeah, that's the problem, is alternative energy that they're pushing towards. They're not pushing towards nuclear or other energy sources that could actually create a base load. And a base load, for your listeners, is the amount of energy needed for any given time to keep the lights on. And that means the lights on in your healthcare facilities, the lights on in your businesses, the lights on across the board. That's the base load. And you take out the material foundation that provides a secure and affordable basis for that, and try to replace it with something that's really not too efficient, it's intermittent and costly. We're going to see more of those types of things that Texas experienced, because you have economics playing a bad role in this too, because you have government subsidies. Like in Texas, the wind companies under the federal tax credit framework could essentially bid negative prices into the market at times where they weren't generating electricity. And how do your other companies in Texas generating energy and oil and gas and coal or whatever compete with that?
Great, great place to hang fire. Okay, here comes the most heinous environmental song ever written and performed.
I look at you now, see your temperature rising, while mighty glaciers weep. I look at you now, see your oceans arising, while nations are lost in the deep. I don't know why nobody told you they stole and fooled you.
Welcome to the second hour of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And my name is Bill Cundiff. And our sponsor this hour is Pape Machinery.
Ta-da.
Yeah, they're our local John Deere ag and turf dealer. And if you need a new mower or a new tractor or implements or pretty much anything ag-related, go up and see them. They can fix you up. If they don't have it, they know where to get it. They've got over 110 locations to draw from, so if they don't have it in stock, they can get on the phone and find it and get it in there for you. So go up and see them. They're located at 3119 Twin View Boulevard in the city of Shasta Lake. They've got great financing, 0% up to 84 months on tractors and mowers. Or give them a call. Their phone number is 530-226-9226. Or catch them on the web at papemachinery.com. Thanks for the hand signals, because I was really getting confused
hand signals
without them. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. On the phone number?
Yeah.
That was pretty helpful,
yeah,
wasn't it?
That was very helpful.
I thought it was super helpful.
I knew I could count on you. Aaron.
Bill. So, free advertisement of the day goes to... I know you thought it was going to be the tiny chainsaw at Pape Machinery.
No,
okay,
no,
that was pretty great.
That was pretty great.
You'll have
to
listen to the last hour for that. But Hilltop Diner. I was
at Hilltop Diner again
the other day. I had something different than I had had before. And I don't know why they don't have a 1,000 people outside waiting to get in. Their food's awesome.
Yeah, you can get in and sit down and get served right away, too. It's not a jam-packed situation. It will be, because people listen to this show, they're going to go in there and get a great meal.
Their
and
beef
it's
comes
get...
from R&R Meats.
Yep,
I mean, their meat's
food.
Really good quality. All their stuff is fresh. And oh, and they have really good cookies, too. I learned about those.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. They have a macadamia white chunk strawberry something or other. And yeah, we had a little accident with the cookies.
Did they identify as pie? Because they do have pie there.
Bill's baiting me. Okay, last week while we were, we'll just tattle. So we had this pie baking contest where we live last weekend. So I decided I was taking cookies because, I don't know, I just seemed like a pain in the rear to make pie. So I took cookies. But I put them in my mother-in-law's pie dish that's kind of fancy. You know, it's glass. It looks like a pie dish, obviously.
There's quality pie dish.
So I thought, hey, I'm going to put cookies in the pie dish. That's funny. And then I was like, no, I'm going to put a note with the cookies in the pie dish. And so my note, beautifully written, said, these cookies identify as delicious pie. And I was just so surprised we didn't win the pie baking contest.
I know.
I thought it was wrong.
Yeah.
Most people thought it was funny. There were two ladies, though. They went over, and one looked at the other one. I could see her talking because they didn't know who brought it. And she's like, who would do this? We're new.
Oh, it's the new people.
It was the new lady. Yeah, so anyway, there you go. Full disclosure. That's what we were doing last week while we were playing a replay on Memorial Day. Oh, my gosh. So, Nathan, where the heck were we before we played the song that by I mean, I'm sure George Harrison really should sue this guy. But when mighty glaciers weep, huh?
Yeah. No, I think we were talking about the energy, green energy situation in California. And on the break, we were talking about how California, I mean, they are headed for a huge train wreck, and nobody seems to really be too concerned about it. But they're forcing everybody to buy electric cars, and I think that's coming in 2035 or something. You'll no longer be able to buy
a gas-powered car.
Everybody has to buy electric. And then they've done nothing to really beef up our power grid. They put in no new hydro. They've done nothing there. And last year, they were telling people with electric cars, please don't charge during these hours because there's going to be possible brownouts. Well, we already are short, and they're pushing everybody towards this green energy. And as you were saying, our grid is not built for that. I mean, during peak times, there's going to be rolling brownouts, and it's going to get worse. We were talking about Texas. It happened to them in the wintertime. People were freezing to death because they put a lot of eggs in the solar or in the wind power, and the turbines all froze and stopped working. And, oh, gosh, there's no electricity in the wintertime. Yeah, who could have saw that coming? But California is still marching towards that same direction, and it's going to happen here, and it's going to be really bad.
It's going to be heinous. With all this crazy rulemaking that you're watching, Nathan, do you see? Are you looking into that, or is it kind of like are you confined for the time being to land use?
Well, my main focus tends to be land use and our natural resource issues, but another area that is a part that I track regularly and a part of the connections I make is from the economic front. So I track a little bit and kind of keep up to date on some of those items, especially the energy front, because energy, I mean, ultimately, even wind and solar, all that, I mean, wind, it takes ground. It's something called power density. There's an equation for how much land it takes to generate a kilowatt hour of electricity, and wind and solar have horrible power density compared to traditional sources of energy. In other words, it takes way more land for wind and solar to get the equivalent of kilowatt hour power delivered onto the grid. You know, so I track and understand it from those perspectives. I guess a lot of what I try to do is to connect those dots between the fact that our land use policy is a directly affected or vice versa on the energy markets and the issues we face, like California going with electric cars and whatnot. You know, they say they want to force everybody to drive electric cars, but the fact of the matter is if they succeed, they're going to force a small amount of people to drive electric cars while the rest of the people are forced into alternative public modes of transportation, because that's just based on the fact that the material resources that they're locking up in our country from being able to even mine and access at the current rate don't even get close to meeting the demand for what they are arbitrarily pushing for. And that's why, as an Austrian economic framework, where I hold to, that's why government shouldn't be in the position of setting prices and driving market investment. That should be something that is dealt with in the free market enterprise, back to what I was alluding to earlier, because then individuals suffer the losses of their risk, and they're not able to directly pass that on to the taxpayer. And therefore, they're also much more efficient in the development of new techniques and investment into new technology that allows us to progress and be more efficient and actually maintain the standard of living that we have created through private property and the means of production. So in those senses, that's part of my vision, is connecting. I don't track as much and get involved policy-wise on the electric car stuff and those spectrums, but I do track it in the context of connecting it to the issues we face in our natural resource industries, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, that does make sense, because obviously you can't watch everything, but there's massive amounts of overlap on all this. And I guess that's the part that can't be overstated. These things are all connected. This isn't happening in a vacuum. They don't want to just mess up a little something over here and a little something over there. Maybe hit a little bit more on what you're seeing on the wider policy front, especially with this, the bureaucrats wanting to do a bunch of rulemaking. Because we started with rulemaking and then we derailed you. Go back to that.
Yeah, well, thank you very much. That's actually a perfect lead-in to touch on a couple things.
2 points
that
for me.
You always have things you want to say on a program, and then usually you don't say them.
because people like me who derail you. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, which is all right. I mean, that's part of the nice thing about having free dialogue and coming together and having a discussion is you also end up saying things that should have been said that you didn't plan on saying. So I'm going to just real briefly here walk through something that's fresh on my desk that I've been looking at to connect. So let me start with this. So Bureau of Land Management, early April, promulgated a rule to revise the regulations for land use planning processes under the Federal Land Policy Management Act to place conservation, leasing, and permitting on par with domestic livestock grazing and oil and gas leasing and the other leases and permits that have traditionally existed under the Federal Land Policy Management Act. So that would essentially bring conservation to the level. And what they mean by conservation is a third party interest that buys and has control of a deeded land that's connected with, and for your listening audience, a lot of federal lands in the West. Like with ranching lands, for example, there's private land that the rancher lives on, and then his land is connected and dependent on a federal or public lands, and they lease that for the domestic livestock interest of that private producer. They're called dependent commensurate properties. So this landscape conservation health rule that BLM is putting forward would allow, for instance, organization like American Prairie Reserve, who's buying up ranches, those private deeded lands with those connections to public land leases, they then could apply to the Bureau of Land Management for a conservation permit that would allow them to utilize that federal land under a non-use paradigm. Remove the livestock grazing. In case they put bison out there as wild animals and take out all the fencing and whatnot. But so with that said, that is a rule that's being promulgated by Department of Interior through Bureau of Land Management, and that rule would touch 230 plus million acres that's under their administrative jurisdiction. So that's problematic in and of itself, but that's the rule that's coming forward. There's no authority in statute for them to do this. It's been shot down by the courts in relationship to the grazing regulations in the past. In 2000, the courts said the Secretary of Interior lacked the statutory authority to issue grazing permits for conservation use, which is non-use. See, right now, the federal government functions under a use-or-lose policy. So if I'm not putting cattle on my grazing lease, I lose it and somebody else has the opportunity to run cattle on that permit or lease. That's how the current framework is. So this conservation leasing rule would upend that whole framework and allow special interests to buy up land and then apply for conservation leases. And then that connects to the 30 by 30 initiative, which calls for tying up 30% of lands and waters into permanent conservation.
Hmm.
So
what's the percentage now? Like, what kind of a change would that be, ballpark?
You know, that's a really good question, and that should be a number that I have on the
right there in front of me.
I don't have the percentage. I know there's a percentage out there. and I have it written somewhere.
That's okay. I just was curious if that was something you'd come across, because I'm thinking 30%, that's a lot. And then, of course, the next thing on my mind was, well, what is it now?
Yeah, it would be significant. There's already quite a bit of land in national parks, as we were discussing earlier, that's already tied up to some extent or another in refuges and national parks, monuments. And so this administration is doing two things. They're expanding the existing frameworks to tie up more lands. But this new rule that's coming out of Bureau of Land Management is creating a whole new mechanism. It functions similar to what perpetual or conservation easements do, except for it's applied to federal lands, and opens up this whole new arena of economic activity. And so that's the problem. So a little bit of a background on this. The environmentalists and scientists have advocated for biodiversity and biological conservation to be the primary goal of domestic public land management and policies. And that has been done through the 90s and up through the thousands. And I will make the note that through all that time, Congress has not acted in drafting a body of law that delegates executive branch to focus primarily on biological conservation. So as a result, the environmental community has more and more called for an ever-increasing role of the executive branch to implement biodiversity conservation initiatives through discretionary measures, which is straying farther and farther away from clearly delegated authorities. So the economic connection here, or go ahead if you're going to say something.
Oh, no, but... Nice timing, though, on that, just because we need to take a quick break. So, well, we've interrupted your thought process by thinking it. That's pretty good. We ESP'd you. We'll be right back. You are listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Oh, I just try to make believe that everything you're telling me is true.
This is Officer Joe with your marijuana message. Don't buy the corporate marijuana lies whose end game is to not pay any taxes. California has failed to control the grows. Dispensaries are selling out the back door as well as selling other illicit substances. Do we really need the damage to the environment, suicide, schizophrenia, hyperemesis, cardiac events in elderly users, drug driving crashes, genetic damage, pulmonary damage, neonatal low birth weight, and lost IQ for our youth? No, we don't. Remember, let's be careful out there.
Who said I see walking in these woods? Why, it's Little Red Riding Hood. Hey there, Little Red Riding Hood. You sure are looking good. You're everything a big bad wolf could want.
Yeah, I was in a quandary there on that song. Couldn't decide if I should play that one or Dude Looks Like a Lady. Those were my choices. 540 songs, and what am I looking at? Little Red Riding Hood or Dude Looks Like a Lady? Terrible. Nathan, back to you. Save me from myself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So just to summarize, I guess, on the leasing rule and to the background there, in the 90s, Secretary of Interior Bruce Babbitt placed biodiversity conservation at the center of Department of Interior's mission for public lands management. And so just before that is when President Clinton signed the Biodiversity Convention in 1993, which was developed at the United Nations Conference on Environment and Development in Rio de Janeiro. But the Senate never acted to advise or ratify the convention. So subsequently, the environmental community has failed to adequately demonstrate that such commitments to biodiversity conservation is anything more than mere rhetoric. And that's evidenced by the fact that Congress over the last 25-plus years has not enacted any laws which authorize, let alone require, far-reaching biodiversity conservation measures. So in other words, under the Biodiversity Convention, they got some things done and they pushed pretty hard, but they never really had the success they wanted. Because ultimately the Senate never did ratify that convention. So now, coming into the modern era of land use planning, what's happening is the environmental community is now pushing for more executive bureaucracy activity to implement biodiversity conservation initiatives. So with the inception of the Paris Accord, what the environmental community is now doing is creating a natural asset class to connect to biodiversity conservation.
Ooh.
That's the economic elements that are coming into play in this process. So you may be familiar, some of your listeners familiar with what's happening in the international finance realm and the White House issuing documents to create a natural asset class, and that ties into your carbon markets and other things. But this also links to this conservation leasing rule. And so this current rule seeks to establish administrative mechanisms in order to facilitate artificial avenues for private investments into natural resource lands without the extractive material products to attach a value to. So that will create an illusion of private market value for the application of non-use of lands, which then will be sold and marketed into the international finance realm as a natural asset class to be purchased by large regulated corporations as a carbon credit to offset their emissions. By the way, this will all be done with no calculable benefits to local governments and citizens. So interestingly enough, basically you'll have, as a result of this rule, in my opinion, if it gets promulgated, the connection to these asset classes that allow corporations, basically in religious terminology, to pay their indulgences.
Sure.
You know, I'm gonna use oil and gas for my purposes, and I'll buy these credits developed by these third party entities applying conservation leases on public lands and creating a economic framework. So this is a very, very dangerous trajectory on the leasing and permitting of our public lands, especially when, and the reason I connect it, just to verify this, to the natural asset class aspect is because the White House published a document early this year called the White House Natural Capital Accounting Strategy, which places conservation as an economic necessity. So these processes seek to arbitrarily place a value on non-use of public lands and then inventory them under the 30 by 30 conservation objectives. The White House document I just mentioned on in Section E, page 12, specifically states, quote, "The planned conservation stewardship atlas," and that's the inventorying tool they're creating, "will function as a tool for tracking a range of conservation benefits provided by U.S. lands and waters, particularly for biodiversity, climate, and equity benefits." So the conservation leasing rule creates a regulatory framework for Department of Interior to transition lands from use to non-use. And the Conservation Stewardship Atlas is the inventorying mechanism that they track that transition. And then they pass that inventory over to the Environmental Protection Agency and the State Department, who then compiles those inventories on Article 4, 7, and 14 of the Paris Accord and delivers that as a contribution to our nationally determined contributions biannually as a global stocktake for carbon emission reductions, because under those nationally determined contributions, land use is included for those decarbonization objectives. Mm-hmm. So these conservation leases, this is, and by the way, everything I just said, those dots I connected, you're not going to see those things on the Federal Register relating to this rule. But the same departments that issued the nationally determined contribution that says we're going to follow the guidance for the IPCC and the CMA annexes that were developed in these international conventions are the same departments that are issuing these rules and regulatory rewrites to transition our lands into conservation status. And then you have the Conservation Stewardship Atlas, which was developed pursuant to the 30 by 30 initiative, to inventory that transition, track it, and report it to the international community as a nationally determined contribution. Some people are connecting those dots, but I would submit to you and your audience that if we don't start recognizing how the international climate agenda is driving domestic policy, we're not going to be able to deal with what's actually happening through these federal departments.
Unbelievable.
And Congress needs to get involved, in my opinion, because they have jurisdiction in Article 1 over international context, such as what I'm bringing forward.
Yeah. And, you know, sometimes it's like anything else. You get so much stuff happening all at the same time, and it's extremely difficult to keep your eye on all the plates that are spinning above your head. And I think that's what these guys count on. You know?
Well, absolutely. I call it a blitzkrieg of administrative rulemaking. And that's what the blitzkrieg in Germany was all about, is, you know, you show up with such, it's all at once.
Right,
we're bringing
right.
all the ammunition, all the tanks, all the hard armory, and we're there before you can even respond. So we have this administrative blitzkrieg. It's not hard armor and tanks and weapons. It's administrative bureaucrats in swivel chairs pumping out rules through federal departments that is fundamentally transitioning the economic and governmental processes that traditionally we've lived under, which is very problematic. And that's why it's causing economic confusion. It's causing inflation and a whole host of other things. And we can't continue down that pathway. And they do that on purpose. One of the only reasons I'm able to bring some of these things forward is because I've personally made this a priority of my desk. I have a document that I'm actually have finished and brought it forward in January that I'm going to be more broadly disseminating, and it's called All Roads Lead to Paris. And it's a chronology that tracks the administrative process under Executive Orders 13990 and 1408 of how those branches and departments are implementing those international timetables and objectives. So the reason I have some level of subject matter expertise on these connections is because I've spent the last 2 years since those orders hit the Federal Register tracking that, reading the documents. So now it's the process that I'm working on now and working with different individuals in doing so is to connect those dots. Because there's Administrative Procedures Act violations of these departments that are not being transparent on the Federal Register with how they're really going to be utilizing these rules that will create administrative mechanisms for agencies to transition lands away from use to non-use, and how that connects to international timetables and objectives that the Congress hasn't spoken on.
Yeah. Well, I know that that the focus after this bill last week was to put them back on regular order for appropriations, and in there, that would give us some ability, finally, to get back to taking money away from these guys for these purposes, provided that they're watching it.
Exactly. There's a lot, and it's sad that the way that all went through, probably there was a lot of compromise, I think, that is allowing kind of a blank check to go out there at this point. We'll see how it all shakes up at the end of the day. But
well, that was kind of the talking point, but there were like 12 members of the Republican Party that were willing to sign on with the Democrats to pass a clean bill out of the House, meaning no limits whatsoever. So
yeah,
they could have wound up with zilch. Fighting the debt ceiling next year made no sense. It's the same configuration. Democrats control the Senate and the White House, so why would you fight it again next year? But that isn't a spending bill. That's not a budget bill. So, you know, I mean, I know there's been a lot of discussion about how they got this blank check, but that's not how money is spent. Money is spent through appropriation. So now, if they don't stick to the limits that were in that bill, automatic sequestration kicks in. And that was kind of like the subtext that nobody really read. But they don't get to spend whatever they want. That isn't how that works. So I'm kind of looking forward to appropriation, because when that comes, then all of this crazy climate stuff and all that is a place we can reel some of it back. But there's no way that they were going to get big cuts through the Senate and through the White House on last week's bill. They were lucky to get anything.
Yeah, well, and so another thing potentially that the Congress could do. So there's a body of law out there. It's called the Federal Advisory Committee Act, and that body of law provides congressional and Senate oversight over discretionary committees. And discretionary committees are committees that are set up by federal departments to advise them in their rulemaking processes. So, like all this climate stuff I've been talking about of what the agencies are doing,
right,
the first thing they did under Executive Order 1408 is they set up the National Climate Task Force, which is made up of the department heads of many of these federal departments. And that's the task force that's advising the Secretary of Interior, developing the nationally determined contributions, and providing advisory and driving the rulemaking processes for the climate policy objectives. So under FACA, there's standing committees that have oversight over these committees, the discretionary committees, and I don't know where those standing committees are, if they're even active or who is on them and whatnot, but that's something most definitely that needs to be, and I'm working on projects that are looking into bringing that forward and getting some congressional oversight, because FACA gives the Congress to abolish committees if they deem them to be unnecessary or illegitimate. And so some potentials there where not only dealing with the funding to these departments, but there's some of these discretionary committees like the National Climate Task Force and other committees that have been established by Deb Haaland and other departments that the Congress could potentially rein in. But it takes people from the ground and local governments feeding the information to our congressmen to inform them and give them the tools they need and the information and data to apply and maybe leverage that and do something about on those, or to get rid of those committees or to rein them in if possible.
Oh yeah, like the groups that you're working with. I think that that's fantastic. I hope you keep us in the loop on that, because we'd love to pass that along. That would be that'd be a really useful thing, especially when all of this budgeting stuff is coming. You have deadlines for that coming by the end of July, actually. The only way they can be on a budget is if they get that. And then we don't have to deal with the omnibus bill and all that stuff at the end of the year, which would be obviously much better. Much better way to spend money, much better way to control it, and potential to reel in the spending, thank God. We have to take a really quick break, and then we will come right back. This will be our break with kind of grumpy songs, and then I'm saving the best for last. You're listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
I remember when I lost my mind. There was something so pleasant about that place. Even your emotions have an echo in so much space. Without care, yeah, I was out of touch. But it wasn't because I didn't know enough. I just knew too much. Does that make me crazy?
for good.
That could be your theme song, Nathan. Oh, my goodness. It does seem like a lot of this is just taking off without us a little bit. I mean, I don't know. It feels like it has sped up. How about that?
Yeah. Well, and, you know, in many ways it has. But, you know, I was just reading this morning in a book that was written by, I believe it was written by Philip de Mornay, one of the French Huguenots, in some of the darker times in France in the 1500s, published originally in the later 1500s. But it's a book that's called, and our founding fathers read and looked to this pretty significantly in their thinking. The title of it is A Defense of Liberty Against Tyrants. And there's a section in that book, the title is, If the Prince May Make New Laws. And that's exactly what we're dealing with this BLM rule and a lot of things being promulgated by the executive department. See, the executive department is there to execute existing law, not make new law. And this book deals with that. And I just want to read just this short little piece here out of it, because he deals with that question. If the prince may make new laws, he says, what then? Shall it not be lawful for a prince to make new laws and abrogate the old, seeing it belongs to the king not only to advise that nothing be done neither against nor to defraud the laws, but also that nothing be wanting to them nor anything too much in them, briefly, that neither age nor lapse of time do abolish or entomb them. If there is anything to abridge, to be added or taken away from them, it is his duty to assemble the estates and to demand their advice and resolution, without presuming to publish anything before the whole have been duly examined and approved by them. That sounds a whole lot like laws promulgated by the just consent of the people, which is in the Declaration of Independence of our country. So Philip de Mornay, 500 years ago nearly, as a French Huguenot suffering administrative central control and power in the church-state system of France at the time, which was squashing the freedom of conscience, the freedom of religion, and the